Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the undarkened corridors of power and we shine a light ahead of us on the path where evolution is leading. The purpose of our Wiki Politiki radio podcast is to, quote, bring left and right front and center to face the music and dance together, to address problems rather than defend positions. We have another purpose as well, and that is to provide context at a time when the content can be contradictory, confusing, and even overwhelming. I particularly appreciate meta-context, which I see as the global overview that lets us see big patterns and rise above the minutiae. And that's what today's show is about, a meta-view of our economic and banking system. I'm really excited about today's show because our guest is Ellen Brown, who has been able to bridge the partisan divide through her book, Web of Debt. I first met Ellen 9 years ago at the Praxis Peace Conference in Sonoma, and I credit her with bringing the conversation about the Federal Reserve, income tax, and the banking industry in general from the domain of right-wing libertarianism into the consciousness of progressive voters. In addition to what I would call a lucid and enlightening narrative about how bankers really have compromised both our economic and our political well-being, Ellen has been an advocate for state banks, like the one that has been successful in North Dakota. She's an attorney, founder of Public Banking Institute. She's a senior fellow of the Democracy Collaborative and author of 12 books, including Web of Debt and The Public Bank Solution, a 13th book titled Banking on the People, Democratizing Finance in the Digital Age, is due out this fall. She also co-hosts a radio program on PRN-FM called It's Our Money, and her articles and blogs are posted at ellenbrown.com. Welcome, Ellen.
Thanks, Steve. Great talking to you.
Great. Well, let's just jump right in. Let's begin with some background for those listeners who may not yet be familiar with your work. To me, Web of Debt, I think, is one of the most important explainers of why our economy is burdened and some would say enslaved by metastasizing debt. And so I'm a big fan and supporter of the state-run bank idea, which we'll talk about later. So, well, tell us about Web of Debt, how it came about, and what the key points are.
Okay. I love your term, metastasizing debt. That's exactly what the issue is. So Web of Debt is basically about the evolution of the Federal Reserve and who actually creates our money supply. Most people think that money is created by the government. They think paper dollar bills and coins represent our money, which of course they do, but only about 5% of the circulating money supply is actually issued by the government and is actually in that physical form. All the digital money, all of it that we use, which is 95% of the money supply, is created by banks when they make loans. So they do it by double entry bookkeeping. I mean, I could go through this long process, but that's how they do it. And we assume that we're dealing in government money, but the banks are actually in control here. So they they determine who gets money and on what terms, that, so they can make very low interest loans to their cronies and to other banks, of course. Banks themselves are in the best position. They borrow at bankers' rates instead of retail rates. They actually get 2% on their deposits with the Federal Reserve, whereas we get almost nothing. That's one reason they've got all those excess deposits just sitting there at the Fed. So the gist of Web of Debt was that we need to take the money power back and how we could do it. So I went into various historical options, one of which was, well, I started with tracing the history. Actually, the theme is The Wizard of Oz. What prompted me to write that book, I was always quite interested in the whole Federal Reserve issue and money issue. I'm a lawyer by trade, or was. I'm retired now. But I didn't really know what I could add that other people hadn't said already, until I discovered that The Wizard of Oz was written as a monetary allegory in the 1890s. So that was pretty interesting, that the theme, it was the first ever march on Washington in 1894, which was a bunch of greenbackers who marched all the way from Ohio to Washington, D.C. They were like farmers who had lost their farms and workers who were out of work due to a depression that everybody knew was created by Wall Street. It was created by the big banks. So they were attempting to get the government to go back to issuing money directly, as Abraham Lincoln did, or as was done by his government. Needless to say, they failed. So now, instead, what we got, instead of what the populace wanted, what we got was the Federal Reserve in 1913, which is really, according to its language, it's really set up to serve the banks and not to serve the people. Like, even when we try to get it to do something where they would get money out directly into the economy, they say, sorry, we can't do it. It's not in the Federal Reserve Act. So that was the basic theme of Web of Debt.
And you know, the Chicago plan, which some people may know, back in the 30s, after the Depression hit, really recommended greatly limiting the power of the Federal Reserve to issue money. And the then Secretary of Treasury under Roosevelt, Henry Morgenthau, convinced him that that was not the way to go. That the I'm trying to remember the name of the British economist who's
Keynes.
Yeah, exactly.
John Maynard Keynes.
So essentially, we didn't take the coaching. Apparently, there were 2/3 of the well-known economists in America in 1933, whenever that were in favor of making that change. And we went the Keynesian route, which had to do with allowing more debt. So tell us more about how this, people imagine that the Federal Reserve, of course, it's a federal, it's part of our government. That's not really true, is it?
Well, there are two parts to the Fed. There's the Federal Reserve Board, which is appointed by the president and confirmed by Congress. So in that sense, it is federal. But there are also the 12 Federal Reserve banks. And they are, if you look on your dollar bills, you can see which of those 12 banks issued your dollar bills. They are 100% owned by the banks in their district. So the banks all have, the member banks have stock, and they get paid a dividend of 6% of what they paid in every year, which is a pretty good return these days for not doing anything. And they have their own boards, and their boards are, of course, dominated by the banks. And then you have your Federal Open Market Committee, which is composed of 12 people. 7 are the Federal Reserve Board, and then 5 are from the 12 Federal Reserve banks. It's one of them is always from the New York Fed. So the New York Fed, which is, of course, where Wall Street is. So the Wall Street banks pretty much call the shots. And all that is behind closed doors, so we don't get to know what their discussions are. So even though there are economists and people writing about, for example, that raising interest rates is going to crash the economy, they do it anyway. And we don't, we have no authority. There's no, we have no way to control that. All that Senate or all Congress could do would be to change the Federal Reserve Act. They don't really have power to step in and say, you are exceeding your mandate, because they're really not. Their mandate is, pretty banker oriented.
Yeah, they got a, that's who their date is with, those men, those banker men. That's their mandate. They've got mandates with the bankers. I was reading about this, back in the 90s, The Creature from Jekyll Island, which was coming from the conservative libertarian end of things. And when I saw you at the Praxis Peace Conference in 2009, it occurred to me that you were really, to many, many people had never heard this idea that the Federal Reserve, really was run by the bankers and for the bankers. And you were the first that I heard that presented this narrative to a progressive audience. Since that time, I've always thought of the public banking issue and the web of debt as being transpartisan, that really there are people on all sides awakening to that. How have you found the education process about the Federal Reserve, both among conservatives and progressives?
Well, you're right. It was that it was really a conservative issue before it was a progressive issue, even though you would think that public banks would be a socialist type thing. Government-owned banks sound socialist. But for some reason, it was the conservatives that were really down on the Fed, trying to – that were exposing the Fed. When I switched over from – in Web of Debt, I was sort of – arguing like they did in the 30s that the Federal Reserve shouldn't be able to, or that banks shouldn't be able to issue the money. But the more I thought about it, I realized that really it's a good system, that to have banks, what the bank really does, they're not really issuing the money. What they're really doing is turning your credit into something you can spend in the marketplace, and that is a good thing. What's mm-hmm. bad about it is that it's privately owned. If it were a publicly owned system, we need that source of credit. If you have it coming from the top, if you just have some monetary authority in Washington dictating how much money is going to be in the system, it's going to be very hard to, make supply and demand meet. But if you have it initiated at the grassroots, when people want money, they go in and take out a mortgage or whatever, and then the bank turns that mortgage into a check that they can spend, then that's a more money is created and extinguished naturally, organically, in response to demand. So that's when I switched over to writing about public banking. But and also after the 2008 collapse, I knew that the Bank of North Dakota, or that North Dakota, was the only state that had its own bank. And so I was watching it, and it turned out it was the only state that stayed in the black. All the rest of the states slipped in the red. So I suspected it had something to do with their bank, so I researched it and started writing about it, and that's how I got I got swamped with emails, and I was complaining to a friend that I couldn't handle them all, and he said, well, why don't you start a Google group, and then they can talk to each other. You don't have to talk to them. So we did that, and we got a lot of interest and a lot of heavy hitters in there who And one woman was from the Federal Reserve, and we had different people who were experts in the field, old money reformers that have been working on this for decades. So after a couple of years, we felt like we were the experts, and so we started the Public Banking Institute, and things have taken off since. But I just wanted to say about your question, North Dakota – the Bank of North Dakota was started by a socialist leader in a very Republican conservative state. So there are a couple of movies about this. He went around I'm not thinking of his name right now. He went around his group, this socialist group, went around trying to convince the farmers that the reason they were losing their farms was because of these out-of-state bankers, and they needed to set up their own bank. but they just were not going to have anything to do with the socialist movement. They were farmers, you know, farmers are Republican typically. My mother's from farmer Republican stock. My father was from auto worker Democratic stock, so I was kind of, grew up confused. Anyway, they did. So they changed the name to the Nonpartisan League, showing that this was not a left issue, not a right issue. It was all about keeping our money in the state for our own purposes, leveraging it for our own purposes, instead of sending our deposits off to Wall Street, which can then use them for their purposes, and the money doesn't come back to our city or our state. So once they changed the character of the movement, that farmers all got on board, he was a very dynamic speaker, and they managed to win an election. And in 1919, they set up the Bank of North Dakota, and it of course, it had a rocky start like those things do. But for the last 20 years, it's been brilliant. It's The Wall Street Journal said it was more profitable than Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase. So it's very profitable, and yet it serves the people. So it shares its profits by making low-interest loans into the community. It gives its dividends to the state, not to its shareholders. And because it's publicly owned, it can take a longer view of what's good for the community and not be always having its eye on short-term profits, like investing in things that people wouldn't necessarily support just because they turn a profit.
Now, the state bank and so on, what's the relationship between the state's assets and the state bank? Is there any relationship?
No. Well, technically, the Bank of North Dakota is set up as North Dakota doing business as the Bank of North Dakota. So technically, you could say that all of the state's assets are assets of the bank, and therefore it doesn't even really need capital. But in order to get a banking license, they had to comply with banking regulations, and we still do. So they got their capital with a bond issue, and that was a big struggle because they were trying to fund this bond issue through the banks that they were going to be competing with. But they did manage to get it and got their bank opened, and they lost the next election. So the Republicans got back in, but they were now they had a bank on their hands, and, you know, a free bank basically. So they took it and ran with it and kept the thing, and
It's interesting because those states up there, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, Minnesota, during that period of time, there was actually a farm labor party that united, at least for that period of time, the workers and the farmers in a common movement. The La Follettes were involved in that, and they elected farm labor, either progressive Republicans or Democrats, for years and years. We're going to take a little break. We'll be back with Ellen Brown. We're talking about Web of Debt, public banking, and some interesting developments in China. Steve Behrman, Wiki Politiki. We'll be back soon.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio. IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
I am Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called Bukavu in the Congo. We were a loving family. And then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day. People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything. I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at EmbraceRefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Okay, this is Steve Behrman. We're back with Ellen Brown. She's the author of Web of Debt. She's the head of the Public Banking Institute. Let's talk a little bit more, Ellen, about the public banks. How exactly has the North Dakota Bank been able to stay in the black while these other banks are in the red?
Well, they have lower operating costs than other banks. So they don't pay bonuses, fees, or commissions. They don't have private shareholders that are bleeding the profits out. They don't. They actually partner with the local banks, so they don't compete with the local banks. So the local bank acts sort of as the front office, dealing directly with the customers. So the Bank of North Dakota doesn't need a lot of branches or ATMs, et cetera. They don't have to advertise for deposits because they have a built-in deposit base. By law, all of the state's revenues are deposited in the Bank of North Dakota. And they don't have to advertise for borrowers because the local banks do that. It's the local banks come to them when they want help with loans maybe that are too big for the local bank that they would have to give away to a Wall Street bank. So by partnering with the Bank of North Dakota, they are able to keep the client and they get the service fees. And the Bank of North Dakota puts in capital and puts in liquidity. And so it's just a very low cost, very profitable business model.
Now, can individuals in North Dakota have accounts at the state bank?
You can technically, but only about 2% of their deposits are individuals. They don't make it real easy. You almost have to live around the corner.
Okay, and you know it's funny when we met. I think it was probably in 2010 or 2011. There was really a big move for a state bank in California, and picking up on the Wizard of Oz theme, we created this song, "If I Only Had a Bank." If you're listening on. You know that show, that song. We weren't able to play it on the air, but when people look at the page on WikiPolitiki, they'll be able to click onto beautiful visuals of Wizard of Oz and hear the new words to the bank song. What's been happening now? It's been about eight or so years since you really launched the Public Bank Initiative. How has it moved along, and what kinds of progress has been made on that?
Well, as with most things, progress is a little slower than we were hoping. As you pointed out, we did have a bill for a feasibility study for a California state-owned bank. It was filed in 2011, but Jerry Brown, it passed both houses of the legislature, but Jerry Brown didn't sign it. He said, it was for a blue ribbon commission. He said, we already had plenty of committees. We didn't need another committee, that they had a banking committee and they could do it in-house. But, of course, they never did it. It died a ritual death, as somebody said.
It went outhouse. That's what happens. If it doesn't go in-house, it goes outhouse. You know, it's really interesting how it surprises many people. I do a lot of interviews with people who are bemused and surprised at how entrenched the system is. But you are making progress. Give me some examples of where cities or states that are considering this right now.
Right. Well, right now it's become just this year. It's become very popular. We're seeing articles appearing all over the place that we didn't have anything to do with, and movements appearing all over the place. So there are probably 50 groups across the country that are advocating for publicly owned banks, and we have 15 pieces of legislation going in different cities and states. California is the most active. Right now, our big push of the moment is there's a bill or a measure on the November ballot in Los Angeles for the voters to approve or giving the city the power to set up a city-owned bank. They still would have to go through all the details, you know, a business plan and making sure all the legislation is correct, capitalization and all that, but just to get voter approval. So that's going to 4 million voters who have not really even heard of public banking, so it's pretty challenging for us. But there's a very active young people's group here, Public Bank LA, a group of millennials that are down there in City Hall all the time. And they were the ones that persuaded the city council to put this measure on the ballot. I mean, we didn't do it. The city council did it. And now we have to scramble around and try to support it. And then we have a public bank alliance across California of, I think they're up to 12 cities now that are looking to form their own banks. And the goal of this alliance is to change the state legislation so they could set up a special charter for public banks, since many of the rules that apply to regular private banks just shouldn't or needn't apply to a public bank.
Well, that sounds good. Like
the governor of New Jersey ran on a public banking platform, and he won, Phil Murphy. So 2 weeks after he was inaugurated, they had a bill on for a public bank. And they're not just a number of – it's just very active right now. So we'll see.
Well, that's good. I think that it's been 10 years since the collapse in 2008. And there have been recent articles about something like 40% of Americans have at least one area of survival that's in question financially. Either they are unable to pay their rent and mortgage, they don't have enough food, medical care, et cetera, et cetera. So, in the great proclaimed prosperity that we have, the economy's doing great, I hear. Nonetheless, it is doing great for some of the people, and for most of the people, as I've joked, it's like living from paycheck to paycheck without the paycheck. So it's been that way for people. In one of your recent posts, you talked about Donald Trump and in his attitude and some possibilities in relation to the Federal Reserve. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about that and your perspective on that?
Okay. Well, for decades, it has been an unspoken rule that presidents didn't criticize the Federal Reserve. But Donald Trump, as we know, has broken every sort of rule. And he said he just expressed his opinion. He said it was just his private opinion that he was very unhappy with the Fed raising interest rates. He said, just as we get the economy going, it's like one step forward, one step backward. The Fed raises interest rates and makes it more difficult for these businesses. So he obviously disapproves of what they're doing, but it looks like they're going to keep raising them. They've raised them, I think, 7 times in the last couple of years. And their excuse for raising them is that prices are going up. Well, why are prices going up? Because they're raising interest rates. Financing is a major cost of every business. And in fact, I saw someone say that it was non-labor costs that were going up. The whole argument for raising interest rates in order to slow the economy is that when you get close to full employment, then labor wants more money. They demand more wages, and then that drives up prices. So that's a concern. But if these are not labor costs going up, these are costs of supplies. And why are they going up? Or, you know, the business costs in general. Because most every business finances itself. Like, they have to pay for workers and materials before they have a product to sell. And they do that on a credit line. They used to do it on a credit line. Now they do it on a credit card, where a lot of small businesses, their credit lines have been cut, not because they are less stable than they used to be. It's just because of all these changes in the banking rules and the, you know.
So now they're having to pay 18 or 20% on some of those, some of the credit cards. It's really easy to run up a debt.
Yeah. And while the banks are raising the rates they're charging us, they're not paying us anymore on our deposits. So they're still getting cheap money and keeping the difference. So it's good for them. It's not good for us.
Do you think that there's a relationship between the way that the economic new word situation and working people voting for Donald Trump in 2016, do you think there's a relationship between that?
Yes, I think people were ready for change, and he represented change. And a lot of people that voted for him were Republicans who were not happy with any of the other Republican candidates. And a lot of people were not happy with Bernie Kraus, for example, people who wanted Bernie to win, and he probably should have won the nomination, were not happy with Hillary. So it was sort of like anybody but Hillary for a lot of people. But I think the economic situation was definitely – it's been a factor globally. We've had all kinds of revolutions going on, and revolutions – back in the direction of populism. It's not necessarily socialism. Sometimes it's far-right populism, but it's back to worrying about what the people need instead of, you know, big government.
Yeah, and I think that there were a lot of progressives were very surprised and shocked when Trump won, in this bubble of how could that happen. And yet, if you look at the Democratic Party policies related primarily to identity issues rather than economic justice. And, you know, that's why, you know, Bernie had the support that he did. And I actually know people who voted for Bernie and then voted for Trump after that. So I just want to go back just a little bit. I seem to remember that your background when you were an attorney had to do with health and food and so on. And I'm wondering how you made the segue from that into writing about banking and the money system.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned Ed Griffin. I read his before he wrote Creature from Jekyll Island, or at least before I read Creature from Jekyll Island, I read his book, World Without Cancer. I wrote 10 books on health and the politics of health, and I represented a cancer therapist in Tijuana who had a brilliant therapy and did really well with terminal cancer patients. But he was arrested and tried for fraud. It was conspiracy to defraud. Somebody up north had recommended patients for him who said he had a high rate of cure for cancer, or high rate of success, I guess, for cancer, but they said that was fraudulent. But it wasn't. Anyway, I worked on his lawsuit for years. He wound up spending 4 years in jail, and I was sort of a minor player on his law team. But I got to know him very well and got to know the whole story, and he was a great – he played that video. There was a video called World Without Cancer that went along with the book, and he played that for all his cancer patients. So it connected – the whole pharmaceutical cartel and their power to the banking system, that they got their power originally from the power to create money, because they were, well, the Rockefellers definitely were started out as both bankers and health people, drug people. So I realized that if you wanted to fix the health problem, if you wanted to get natural remedies back on the market and able to even make claims about what they could do, that you had to fix the monetary system, that that's where the real power came from. So then I jumped over. But I had researched the Federal Reserve a lot. I just didn't know what I could say until I discovered that Wizard of Oz hook, which I thought was real fun to do.
It is. It is. I mean, that's such a compelling story, the book, the movie, everything, and to recognize, like so many seemingly innocent parodies, it really had to do with the big social issues of that time, whether it's greenbacks or silver, as opposed to the limited currency in the gold standard. And this has been a challenge for people, obviously, for more than a century, because that was going on turn of last century. So very interesting that you make that bridge, because these days, in a certain regard, there's a very complex issue related to vaccinations, alternative health, and so on. And all of those things are being very conveniently lumped into those right-wing conspiracy theories like Pizzagate. So people need to be a bit more discerning about what they dismiss and what they accept. How are you finding all of these twisted narratives and quote-unquote conspiracy theories?
Well, I'm an avid watcher of podcasts along the conspiracy line. It's just the whole Agenda 21 thing. I mean, these fires in California were so suspicious. There's something very strange about those fires. If you watch those videos... So it's just interesting. I mean, I'm a writer first and foremost. My first degree was in English before I went to law school. I only went to law school because I couldn't support myself as a writer. And it took writing skills. It was one of those things where they accepted your writing grades. So those things are just really keenly interesting to me. So I'm always trying to sort through what's really going on. And there's a lot going on that's very deep, that's, it's not what we see at all. The major media it is fake news. I have to agree, it's fake news.
Well, that's been very interesting. When we come back, we're going to be talking more about China and then some other some of the current trends in relation to public banking and the Federal Reserve. Steve Behrman. My guest is Ellen Brown. She's the author of Web of Debt.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living. A chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network, presenting transformative programs and events to help you waken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
My name is Meera Batra, and this is How I Live United. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to see opportunities available. We help them get involved with their kids, schools, and network within the community. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunity and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Steve Behrman here, and we're back with our final segment with Ellen Brown. She's the author of Web of Debt, head of the Public Banking Institute. In your latest writings, you talk about China and how they are bypassing banks entirely. Say more about that.
Well, they have two big global marketplaces, online global marketplaces, arrangements, rather, like Amazon, that have their own money system. So one is called Alipay and one is called WeChat. So it's the equivalent of Amazon and Facebook, where things are bought and sold. But what people do is they don't need credit cards for this. So it basically bypasses the banks, and you can purchase things like at McDonald's or anywhere using your phone, and what you have is the equivalent of a barcode that you just aim at the barcode on the counter. And even street merchants are using these. All you have to do is paste your barcode up on your little vendor thing, so they don't need to buy into the system of the credit card system. And it's much cheaper for the merchants. For the little merchants, it's free. And even for the larger merchants, it's less than half of what they would pay for, say, PayPal or Visa or MasterCard. So they're cutting the banks out, and which is quite alarming. And this is huge. Like, they did $13 trillion in business, I think, last year, or just in the first 10 months of last year. So the bankers and credit card companies are worried about it. The American bankers and credit card companies are worried about this sort of system cutting them out. In China, what happens is that banks are kind of stuck with the hard stuff, like doing all the reporting requirements, but they're just being used as they were called dumb pipes, that the money's just taken out of the bank, and then this online marketplace gets all the perks. And Amazon is kind of inching in that direction now. So what I concluded in this article was that the problem with Amazon, of course, is they're another one of these big corporatocracies. But what the potential is what if we actually nationalized Amazon, or made it into a public utility, or had a separate public utility that was like that. So a big public banking system in which you could also buy and sell products, where it was kind of like a community currency, an online community currency, but that was huge and that was virtually, very cheap in terms of doing the trades.
Wow, what an interesting idea. Of course, Amazon is one of the new evil empires out there.
Warren was actually talking about turning it, some people said nationalizing it, but I think she really meant turning it into a public utility. That's been a recent bill she's trying to get And
well, that's a really interesting idea, given all of the hullabaloo about capitalism, socialism, all of these isms. Do you think that that's something that that the American people could get past this the icon of capitalism, even though more and more people are recognizing that it really, you know, it's been a system for exploitation and domination?
Yes, I think they've used these terms to pit us against each other. There's an actual attempt to create a civil war in the U.S., it looks like, so I see on the alternative media. So if we can get back past these names, we're in the 21st century. We've got all this computer power that we never had before. I mean, Google, to me, has transformed my life. I just live on my computer now. I never go to a library. So we've got all these new tools, and it's clearly time to come up with a new means of exchange. I know there's a lot of concern about eliminating cash, that there's a push to go cashless, and that once they do, of course, they will have total power over our money. If they want to turn us off, they can. But there's no need to go cashless. You could, or you can, whatever, keep gold or something physical. I mean, we don't, first of all, we don't really have much choice in the matter. If they go cashless, there's not much we can do about it. In India, they banned certain large bills, and the people had no voice in the matter. So let's assume that that's where they're going. What we really need to do, a lot of people are trying to escape government, like with Bitcoin, et cetera. But yeah, we can't escape government. They will regulate us. They will. What we need to do is take back our government. It's supposed to be a government of the people, by the people, for the people. And we need to make it that again. And how can we do that? The first place to start is with the money system. If we had our own publicly owned banks, if we had our own sort of public community currency system that was online, that was big enough that you could actually find stuff. I mean, I've been in online community currencies, but the problem is they're so small that there's really nothing you want to buy necessarily, or nobody wants to buy your goods. But if it were huge, like Amazon, you could just envision a whole different – that's what I like to write about, is the potential here, the potential for a new way of trading, that where money is considered a public utility, just like water and power and roads, all those things that we share that connect each other, that we need – a public system for. Like, you need other people to recognize what your little green piece of paper stands for. It's not even cash is really worthless, except that the government says it's worth something. So that needs to be a public utility, which it should be. So that's what I write about.
Well, you know, you're talking about the cashless society. I happen to know people who are completely cashless right now. They have no cash whatsoever. The joke is that they're dealing with microcurrencies, learning how to manage very, very, very tiny amounts of money. So I think a lot of people in the economy are having to do that. What's your – have you even talked anything – that's a joke. We haven't talked – they haven't talked – these are time release. It's okay. We haven't talked very much about, or at all, about cryptocurrency. What's your take on cryptocurrency?
Well, it's very interesting. I do think that Bitcoin, I don't think, can be a national currency because it's too expensive, way too energy intensive. And to do even just to buy a cup of coffee is a very expensive thing, unless you go through an exchange. And if you go through an exchange, it's already centralized. So you've eliminated the alleged advantages of Bitcoin. But all this research that's going on has potential. If we were to set up something like a big community currency system that worked digitally, you would need some sort of program that made sure that it was safe and that maintained some sort of anonymity, all those things. Well, actually, in a community currency, you don't want to be anonymous. You want to be known because mm-hmm. you want other people to buy your goods. And so you want all those reviews that say, oh, yeah, this person can be trusted and their goods are worthwhile or whatever. So it is a different system. But so I think it's very interesting development, and I think interesting things will come of it. But they haven't yet come up with a cryptocurrency that would work as a national currency. I could actually see it as a national currency. I mean, here's what I think it would be the ultimate, is that the Federal Reserve should be nationalized. We should make it into a public utility. And then it should issue... We should all get to have an account at the central bank. Right now, the bankers, only bankers have accounts at the central bank. They get paid 2% guaranteed. They have a totally safe system. Their trades occur instantly. There are a lot of perks to being in the Fed system. But we are in the private banker system with all those. Oh, and also, if we were banking with the central bank, there would be no fear of bankruptcy. You wouldn't need deposit insurance. You wouldn't have a $250,000 cap, which is what has driven people or big pension funds, et cetera, into the repo market, because they don't feel like their money is safe just in a deposit account in a bank. So they put it in the repo market. And it was actually a run on the repo market that crashed the economy in 2008. So let's assume that you had the central bank as... Everybody could bank at the central bank. You wouldn't have to. You could still have the option of private banks. But that option would be there. And then in the course of that, they could issue this digital currency. If they issued digital dollars, the government would once again be issuing our money instead of private banks issuing it. So we would actually be going back to the public banking system of Benjamin Franklin's colony of Pennsylvania and of Abraham Lincoln's greenbacks, where the government issued the money, but through their publicly owned, publicly controlled public utility central bank.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned earlier that the ones who have taken up the issue in LA are the young people, the millennials. And so I think that, you know, people who are younger are less burdened by these ideological distinctions like capitalist or socialist. And I think there's much more of an opportunity for change. And I really want to jump onto this money as a public utility, the Federal Reserve as a public utility. This seems to be ultimately a transpartisan, you mentioned the nonpartisan league helping to push across this banking, the North Dakota Bank in 1919, almost 100 years ago. Do you see any promising signs that people are ready to transcend the ideological arguments and start getting practical about what's going to work here?
Well, I agree. The millennials are sort of our hope in this. And I think one reason they're jumping on this bandwagon is that they've actually been screwed out of their birthright. They came into the world, unlike us, you know, where my dad supported a family of four kids and a house and cars and college and all those things on one income. And mm-hmm. it was, everybody did it in those days. And now they can barely do it on two incomes. Housing is out of sight. The price of housing and rents, even rents are very high. And there's been, I guess the job market is opening up somewhat, but they come out of school, maybe $100,000 in debt, and then they can't get a job, or they can't get a job in that field that was supposed to be lucrative enough to pay back their debt. So they just remain in debt forever. So of course they're not at all happy with this capitalist system where there's no guarantee, there's no safety net for them. You need Social Security when you're 65, but if you're 25 and out of work, you're kind of out of luck.
You know, and then you're with the gig economy, and there's no benefits. There's no insurance, nothing like that. It's you know, it's Uber. You know, people have to do that. You know, with college degrees or drive. Your sheepskin won't be helpful anymore. It's Uber, and that's what's going on with a lot of people. And you know, you could qualify that as employment, but as you said, it's taking two incomes. What do you see on the horizon that gives you the most encouragement right now?
Well, we're definitely seeing a lot of action in the public banking space. Like I said, there are articles coming out all the time from people we didn't have anything to do with. And just the fact that there's more and more ability to know what's going on in other places in the world. So they can't really pull the wool over our eyes like they used to. We have all these sources of information that it seems to me that, and then we just have all this innovation going on, like in the cryptocurrency space, but a lot of new developments happening. So it does seem to me that we have to have a new system. The old system's not working. The government's $21 trillion in debt. It's been estimated that at the rate we're going, by 2027, we're going to be paying $1 trillion a year. We collectively, just in interest on the federal debt, which is stupid. There's no need to even have, we don't need to pay interest at all. We should have funded that debt through our own central bank from the very beginning.
Didn't Milton Friedman have a plan to do that many years ago, back in the 70s? I seem to remember that Milton Friedman floated this idea of having the government buy up all this debt and then issue them as federally issued dollars, and slowly, you know, pay off all the Federal Reserve. I was very surprised that it was Milton Friedman who came up with this idea. Am I correct about that?
Well, he definitely came up with the helicopter money image, that it was easy enough to cure a deflation. Just drop some money from helicopters and get it out there in the system. So
yeah, I think in a parallel,
you can't just write off the federal debt, because that debt is held by somebody, and they're going to be out of luck, some pension fund or whatever. But what you can do is just pay it. Just print the money or issue the money digitally and pay it. Buy those bonds back. Leave them sitting on the books of the Federal Reserve. I mean, you can't say that this can't be done, because they just did it to the tune of, I think, $2.7 trillion of the quantitative easing was federal debt.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Ellen Brown. She can be found at ellenbrown.com. She's the author of Web of Debt. And this is Steve Behrman, WikiPolitiki. Again, thank you, Ellen, for being our guest today.
Thank you.